Moncrief on News Talk.
Time for Moncrief's Murder Club today. Cassie Delaney will be guiding us through some criminal cases, almost where the criminals were caught by accident to a degree. It's really weird. And this first guy, Robert Durst, on paper, had it all.
Had it all, got away with it for so long. So a lot of these cases are really well-known killers, but the details in which they got caught mightn't be as known. The first one, Robert Durst, a very rich and entitled man, born into money, so massive, it was like he just was operating an entirely different world, didn't have any worries whatsoever. His father, Seymour, had built one of the most valuable real estate portfolios in all of New York. They owned the One Penn Plaza, the Newsday building, and massive, massive money. And Robert was the eldest son. So for all intents and purposes, he was supposed to inherit the business and he was supposed to inherit most of the wealth. But his father bypassed him and gave control to his younger brother, Douglas, instead, without ever really explaining why. But I think it becomes quite clear when we get to know Robert a little bit better. Robert was quite a difficult man. He was apparently brilliant in some ways, but quite volatile. He had a habit of disappearing without warning and often starting over somewhere new under different names or walking away from things that people would have worked really hard to fight for. In 1973, he married a woman called Kathy McCormick, and she was only 21 when they first met, only 3 months away from finishing medical school when she vanished without a trace. So the last time anyone saw Kathy, it was the night of January 31st, 1982. Robert told police when they were investigating her disappearance that he had driven her to the train station in New York so she could go back to the city for classes. But then 5 days later, he reported her missing. Now, witnesses said that she'd been at a party just before he reportedly dropped her to the train station and that she seemed frightened and nervous and Robert had come in to tell her to come home. The investigation, for whatever reason, goes nowhere, even though Kathy's family suspected Robert from pretty much the beginning. The police admitted later that they didn't really pursue sufficiently kind of these theories around Robert. Oh. He managed to divorce Kathy in 1990 on the grounds of legal abandonment. So nobody, no investigation.
She wasn't officially dead.
She wasn't declared officially dead. And he got away with divorce. He remarried, got on with his life. But 18 years later, in the autumn of 2000, investigators are trying to take a fresh look at the case. And they wanted to speak to a woman called Susan Berman, who was one of Robert's close friends in their 20s. She was a writer who had been friends with Robert pretty much throughout his entire life. And around the time of Kathy's disappearance, she had said to a friend, "I did something today and I did it for Bobby," implying that she had kind of given him his alibi when he really needed one.
Uh-huh.
Investigators were scheduled to go fly out to meet her. But then on Christmas Eve, Susan is found shot in the back of the head at her home. Total execution style, but again, no forced entry. So the killer must have known her or at least been familiar with the house. No suspects identified and the case goes cold. There seems to be a little bit of interference here, maybe. Robert Durst then did something very, very strange that no one has ever fully explained. He went to Texas, rented a room in a boarding house, disguised himself as a mute woman. He wore a wig, he paid in cash, kept to himself, gave himself the name Dorothy. He was eventually identified by a neighbour who recognised him from newspaper photographs and police were looking to contact him. But before that had happened, his next door neighbour, who was just a retired man named Morris Black, also turned up dead. He specifically turned up in Galveston Bay, which is near where Robert Durst was found pretending to be the mute woman. Body in pieces, the head never recovered.
Oh, God.
Absolutely brutal. So Durst was arrested. He admitted to killing Black, but his defense was that it was self-defense. He said that Black came at him with a gun and he had struggled and the gun went off. And then he had panicked and dismembered the body. Now, you know, you panic.
Panic is running away.
Panic is not taking a head off a body and throwing and driving it across state lines and throwing it in a bay. Somehow he gets off and acquitted of this murder.
I assume he didn't inherit the fortune, but he was still well got.
He's still very, very wealthy. He still has access to an awful lot of money. So we're 3 deaths in, no convictions, and Robert Durst is still out free. At this point in time, you would think that he would just settle into retirement and maybe just go quietly into the night. But instead, he decides that he'll participate in a documentary called The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, thinking that this documentary was going to be quite sympathetic towards him. He actually approached the filmmaker himself to be a participant. And for 2 years, he gives interviews. They're kind of up and down. He's calm, reflective. He's charming. He answers questions about his entire life, about Kathy, Susan and Morris Black. And after 2 years of filming, the film crew have collected all these little variant bits of evidence. And one of them is a letter that he wrote to Susan. And another one is a letter that had been anonymously sent to police about the location of Susan's body. And the handwriting on them both was identical, but also there was a misspelling of the word Beverly. So Robert looks at these two letters. He's presented with them at the final kind of clip. He's presented with this piece of evidence and he asks for a break, but still mic'd up. He walks into the bathroom and starts to talk to himself, mutters to himself. And he says, there it is. You're caught. You're right, of course. But you can't imagine arresting him. He's kind of mumbling as if he's talking to voices in his head, but essentially looking at himself in the mirror while still mic'd up in front of the documentary crew. He admits to all three murders. So the crew did what any documentary crew would do, sat on it for a while, put it into the film, decided to wait. And the night before the final episode of that documentary was to air, the FBI arrested him in 2015 in New Orleans. And on his possession at the time was $40,000 in cash, a loaded revolver, a fake passport and marijuana. His defense for that case was that he had been high on meth during parts of the filming, but he was still finally convicted and sentenced to life without parole.
It's extraordinary. And I wonder, were there any inquiries within the various police forces afterwards? Because even the handwriting analysis is missed. Things are missed.
You have to look at things. If a documentary film crew can solve three murders in the space of 2 years and police had been avoiding it or not been able to do it for years, there's got to be some bit of corruption in there.
Yeah.
Surely.
Or incompetence. Mm. Or just kind of deference to rich people. Right. Okay. Our second story. That first one was quite strange. This one is just off the charts bizarre.
Speaking of incompetence, this one is so, so strange. So we're going back to 1974. There is a family called the Otaro family and Joseph, the father, doesn't show up for work. A neighbour goes in to check in the family and she found that Joseph, his wife Julie, their son and their daughter had all been murdered. Three other children in that family had all been in school that morning and come home, basically discovered that their whole family had been killed. It's very, very sad. And the killer behind this was a man called Dennis Rader. He had chosen that particular family because he had developed what he called a blueprint and a method for stalking and killing people. So he kept journals, drawings, fantasies. He stalked families in meticulous detail and he called it Factor X. He said it was a compulsion that was separate to himself, something he believed he'd been born with and could not control. But he selected victims, stalked them for ages and brought with him his murder kit to kind of, fulfill his fantasy. Yeah. I mean, in it was a rope, tape, just awful things. Between 1974 and 1991, he murdered at least 10 people and they were mainly women, a lot of single women, but there could have been any. Like there was a 62-year-old man in there. He was just at it for like a really long time, uncaught.
Would he kill them all in the same way? Or
yeah, so his whole thing was kind of bind, torture, and kill. So it was very like this is gruesome kind of stuff, and this is definitely someone who was particularly evil. But between these kills, as some serial killers seemed to do, he would look for attention. So he wrote letters to the police and to newspapers, these long kind of self-important letters about his ego, misspelled. He described himself as a genius, demanded attention, complained to the press that the press was not covering his work adequately. And he just wanted to be known. He wanted that notoriety. But between intervals of killing, he would sometimes go completely quiet. And so after 1991, there was nothing for years and years and years, absolute nothing. So investigators thought that he had died or moved away or simply stopped.
And at this point, they, to be clear, they knew his name. He'd given them his name.
They'd given himself a name. So he called himself Rex.
Right, okay.
And that's how he likes to be addressed.
Yeah.
Like a dinosaur in the press. But during the years that he was quieter, he was living a very normal suburban life. He was married. He had two children. He worked, and I think this is a real chilling detail, installing home security systems inside people's houses. He was a compliance officer for his local council, so responsible for enforcing things like neighborhood watchdog stuff, like clean streets. He would give people tickets for overgrown lawns. Like he was, you know, he was a scout leader, and he was he was very active in his church and the Christ Lutheran Church. So quite a fundamentalist Christian, big beliefs, big family guy. But by all intents and purposes, a very big pillar of the community. But he was afraid that he would be forgotten. So in 2004, after 13 years of silence, on the 30th anniversary of the killing of that family, the letters started picking up again. He was sending them out to local news stations, containing photographs taken at crime scenes, details that only the killer could have known, and long essays about what he wanted his legacy to be. He was 79 years old at this time. He really could have just done nothing and gotten away with it. And one package arrived into a news station at a time asking a very specific question. So bearing in mind now, this is 2004 when the internet is in full swing.
Mm.
He asked if it was possible to send in a floppy disk and if that floppy disk could be tracked back to the computer that the information was written on. The task force, led by a man called Lieutenant Ken Landwehr, placed an advertising, as Rex had asked, placed an advert in the classified section of the Wichita Eagle for a response to this question. And the advertisement said to him, "Rex, it will be okay."
Mm.
So Dennis goes and sends the floppy disk into the investigation. And they, within an hour, have traced it back to the computer the original files came from. So he sent it in, and this must have been a mad kind of discovery in the investigation room. The computer it was traced back to was in the Christ Lutheran Church in Park City. So imagine getting that information out of them. And it sent them right back to him. Dennis Rader was caught. And then when they had his name, they were able to match his DNA with samples that had been taken from the crime scenes back in the olden times. He was absolutely shocked when he was arrested because he couldn't believe the investigation team had lied to him. And when his first question was, "How come you lied to me? How come you lied?" And Landwehr just replied, "Because I was trying to catch you."
Yeah.
But his mind was boggled that they would catch him out like this and not be trustworthy investigators.
Almost as if, perhaps in his mind, he'd built up that they had a certain amount of respect for him and that there were rules here.
I think so. I think he thought he was really well regarded, that he was some sort of genius who deserved to evade criminal justice. But like, this is just so silly. And at a time where he could have simply Googled, "Can a floppy disk be traced back to a computer?" And within seconds been told that, yes, actually, of course it can.
But he was 79. I suppose he wasn't keeping up with the...
He was better
at the old-fashioned crime and serial killing.
Even if he'd asked someone to Google that question for him, it wouldn't have really raised that amount of suspicion if you'd had kind of a senior citizen ask about a floppy disk. You'd be like, there's a question. You're hardly thinking it's full of information about historical murders.
Presumably there was other evidence as well, though, not just his floppy disk.
Of course, there was DNA evidence. There was other little trinkets he'd had, and then all the information that was on the floppy disk as well, of course, that only he could have known.
That's extraordinary.
Isn't it?
Is he still alive?
He died in prison as well. Same with Robert Durst is dead in prison as well.
Yeah. The Robert Durst documentary apparently is on HBO Max, according to a listener.
It's well worth the watch.
And it's a very good watch. Rex is Latin for king, which would tie in with the self-importance. Perhaps, yes. Or was...
I prefer dinosaur.
It was the name of his favourite dog, perhaps, or something. Right. Now, this is interesting because this guy's also serial, but it's very English because it's kind of grim. It's like a serial killer in Coronation Street kind of thing.
Isn't it? It's so... Actually, I once did the data points on where's the most dangerous place to live, and murders per capita, Carnation Street is like four times more dangerous than the worst place on earth. Bear that in mind if you're travelling to the UK. Dennis Nielsen is a very interesting character. Again, from the outside, very normal. A civil servant in North London working in a job centre. He wore glasses. He went to union meetings. He was considered quite competent and thorough. but he was also profoundly lonely. He lived alone and sometimes had a mirror staged to make it himself feel like there was somebody else living with him, which is sad. Okay, we can't feel sorry for serial killers. In December 1978, he committed his first murder. He was bringing men home from the pub, and in the morning, apparently afraid that they would leave, he strangled them. He killed 11 more men over the next 4 years. He chose carefully homeless men, runaways, drifters, people that nobody would miss. He brought them home, gave them food and somewhere to sleep, but then he killed them. And he kept the bodies for days before he could bring himself to let them go. At first, he was burying them in the garden, but when he moved to the top floor flat with no garden, he improvised and he began cutting them up, boiling flesh, dissecting the bodies and flushing them down the drain. This is how Dennis Nielsen got caught. In February 1983, the drains at Cranley Gardens, where he lived, began backing up. Nielsen, along with other tenants, complained about the blocked drains, never stopping to think, I wonder what could be down those drains that's blocking it. Complained about the blocked drains. And when the kind of dino rod plumber was called out, he lifted the manhole cover and found exactly what you expect to find, dismembered parts of bodies, flesh, and he held up the pieces. So the police were called immediately. We're waiting when Nielsen arrived home from work that evening with his little briefcase and his grey suit. They said there was a problem with the drains. They invited him in and he saw it. And when he was asked, are we talking about one body or two? Nielsen responded, about 15 or 16, I think.
He thinks.
So grim.
Is he still alive?
He died in prison in 2018.
Yeah, my word. Cassie, thanks a million as ever. That was Cassie Delaney there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.